the headlines, people in Bahrain take to the streets to protest the death in custody of a political prisoner. A U.S. police trainer testifies that the neck restraint applied by former officer Derek Chauvin in the deadly arrest of African-American George Floyd was unauthorized. And the Canadian Prime Minister says his country is facing a very serious third wave of the coronavirus as hospitalizations are surging and intensive care beds are filling up. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, Bahrainis have staged a demonstration to protest the death of a political prisoner. The demonstrators chanted slogans in solidarity with Abbas Malullah's family. Malullah died in prison due to medical negligence, as well as harrowing, dangerous, and inhumane conditions in prisons run by the Al Khalifa regime. This comes as Bahrain's most prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, had recently called for the release of political prisoners amid the coronavirus pandemic. Human rights organizations have already criticized Bahrain over the situation of its prisons. The facilities are said to be overcrowded and lacking proper sanitation. And Iran says the latest round of nuclear talks in Vienna has shown that all parties involved believe in the efficacy of the 2015 accord. President Hassan Rouhani said there's a unanimous voice saying that the Iran nuclear deal is the best option. Rouhani added that the U.S. needs to, quote, repent for its actions against Iran for rejoining the deal it left 3 years ago. He said if the U.S. demonstrates enough seriousness and sincerity, it can re-enter the accord. Rather, Rouhani reiterated that Iran will return to its nuclear obligations only after the U.S. implements its own commitments under the agreement.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining participants of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. The sides have set up two expert-level working groups that are going to come up with two lists, one of sanctions to be lifted by the United States and the other of nuclear measures to be undertaken by Iran in order for the country to return to full compliance with the nuclear agreement. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says Tehran is not interested in any step-by-step return to the deal and is demanding the full removal of sanctions imposed, reimposed or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA.
I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. After verification, we certainly go back to full compliance.
Iran says it has not and will not engage in any direct or indirect talks with the U.S., and it would be up to the other JCPOA signatories, namely Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia, to talk to the Americans. The Joint Commission will meet again in Vienna on Friday to review the work of the expert groups and discuss sequence and timing. But if there's a lack of progress, Tehran says, it will end the talks. We are not in a hurry, says Iran's lead delegate. Homolezgi, Vienna.
Iran's top negotiator Abbas Araghchi says the first round of negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal was constructive. However, he says it's too early to call the talks successful.
I think it was constructive and in the right track. It's too soon to say that it has been successful. That would be known after the work of the working groups. But of course, we are hopeful. If we were not hopeful, we would have not been here. We would move based on our own policies, on our own instructions. If the other side can, meet our demands, of course, then we can say that it's a successful negotiation. So we have to make it clear that this is our position, but we are quite serious. I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. And after verification, we certainly go back to full compliance. If we wanted to avoid full compliance to the JCPOA, we would have done it before. We would have totally withdrawn from the JCPOA once the U.S. the previous U.S. administration left the JCPOA. So we are quite serious. Nobody can question Iran's goodwill. The JCPOA is alive because of Iran, and we have paid a heavy price for that. Our people have suffered from the sanctions imposed by the United States. And now, if they want to revive JCPOA, if they want to come back to the JCPOA, they should lift all sanctions at once.
The European Union describes as rather constructive Tuesday's talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. European Union Chief Coordinator Enrique Mora said the bloc will increase separate contacts with the U.S. and JCPOA partners. The U.S. State Department also said the Vienna talks were constructive. Robert Malley, the envoy heading the U.S. delegation, said Washington's maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed. Earlier, a spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry said Washington should return to the nuclear pact unconditionally and lift all, quote, illegal sanctions against Tehran. Zhao Lijian described the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA as the reason for the deal falling into disarray. U.S. media say Israeli officials have notified the United States about targeting an Iranian vessel in the Red Sea. An official who spoke on condition of anonymity has told the New York Times that the Israelis called the attack a retaliation for earlier Iranian strikes on Israeli vessels. The official said the Iranian ship called Savis was damaged below the waterline. Other sources say no American forces were involved in the assault. Reports say the incident happened by limpet mines off the coast of Eritrea. No details have been provided by Iranian authorities regarding the attack. The vessel has been stationed in the Red Sea for the past few years to support Iranian commandos as part of anti-piracy escort missions. The day seven of the trial of white former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin for murdering African-American George Floyd has concluded. A Minneapolis police lieutenant testifies that the move used by Chauvin was not an authorized neck restraint.
Knee on the neck would be something that does happen in use of force that isn't unauthorized.
And so if there was, say for example, the subject was under control and handcuffed, would this be authorized?
I would say no.
If you could take
Johnny Mercer, who teaches the proper use of force for the city's police department, gave this statement after he was shown a photograph of Chauvin using his knee to pin Floyd's neck to the ground. Mercer also stated that the officers attempting to restrain Floyd were not able to touch and examine the carotid artery, considering Chauvin's knee placement. Meanwhile, Officer Nicole McKenzie, who leads the Minneapolis Police Department's emergency medical response training, told jurors that the police are trained to check the pulse and perform CPR when necessary.
And what are officers trained to do if they are unable to find a pulse?
If you don't have a pulse on a person, you'll immediately start CPR. There is a possibility that somebody could be in respiratory distress and still being able to verbalize it. Just because they're speaking doesn't mean they're breathing adequately.
The testimonies came a day after the Minneapolis police chief said the neck restraint used by Chauvin on the deputy arrest violated the department's policy. The police chief said Chauvin broke rules and ethics codes and also noted that his actions were not part of police training. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges. His defense team has argued that Chauvin did only what he was trained to do in his 19 years as a police officer. 46-year-old Floyd's death sparked massive protests against police brutality in the U.S. We were earlier joined by Colin Campbell for more details on the seventh day of Floyd's murder trial. Here's what he had to say.
Although the accused, the defense, has a history of being a police officer, the technique that he used, according to experts, people who are familiar with his field, are saying that he did use improper technique. And of course, this really attacks the defense for the type of characterization they're trying to play up Derek Chauvin as, an experienced police officer, someone who was afraid of George Floyd because he might have had something in his system, somebody who was resisting constantly. This kind of flew in the face of all of that, and saying that once a person is in prone position on the ground, face down on the ground, and in handcuffs, and is not moving, that person is really no longer a threat to the police. The defense still has a very difficult case to point out here because of all of the people that are coming in saying that the police officer used excessive force, had his knee on the neck for too long, did not use proper procedure, that something could have been done that could have kept George Floyd alive, but kept him incarcerated or detained. When you look at just police officers being convicted, you see that there's a disproportionate use of the justice system. And then when you look at the people who are killed by police, you can see that those statistics are skewed as well. When you break it down by percentage, you'll find that a black person is three times more likely to be killed by police than a white person. And then when that happens, police officers rarely, if at all, ever facing a serious penalty for that conviction.
The U.S. envoy to Central American countries says the White House is seeking to create legal ways for Central American migrants to reach the United States.
We are here to talk about the need and the efforts of the White House to create legal means for migration so that people do not have to use irregular and dangerous routes, where we have seen tragedies like the one that happened in Mexico a few weeks ago that profoundly affected the Guatemalan people.
Zuniga says U.S. administration is also seeking to provide better care for migrants in transit and returnees. A jump in immigration from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador has posed one of the biggest political challenges to the Biden administration. The U.S. president has been criticized for exposing migrants to great risks following reports of murders and kidnappings along migrants' way to U.S. borders. Only in March, more than 171,000 migrants have been arrested by U.S. authorities along the U.S.-Mexico border. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has warned against the variant-driven third wave of the coronavirus pandemic in his country. Trudeau said the very serious new wave of the virus pushed up hospitalizations and filled up intensive care beds across Canada. Over the past week, the country reported more than 5,000 new cases of COVID-19 per day. Canadian officials are calling for more drastic measures in the affected provinces. The city of Toronto has also canceled all in-person learning at elementary and secondary schools. Brazil, the worst-hit Latin American country, has set another single-day record in its COVID deaths. It confirmed nearly 4,200 fatalities and almost 87,000 cases in 24 hours. India has reported a record number of 115,000 daily coronavirus cases. The spike has taken the country's total to 12.8 million infections. India's death toll now stands at over 166,000. Authorities have already imposed a nighttime curfew in the hardest hit state of Maharashtra, as well as the capital, New Delhi. Health officials have warned that the next 4 weeks will be very critical in India's fight against the pandemic. Elsewhere in Asia, South Korea registered 668 new coronavirus cases, its highest daily caseload in 3 months. Health authorities say over 60% of the infections belong to Seoul and neighboring regions. South Korea has reported more than 106,000 cases and over 1,700 fatalities. While the UK continues its slow but steady march out of lockdown, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced that businesses from barbers to bookstores would be allowed to reopen next week. While that has been received as good news, his floating of the contentious idea of a vaccine certification scheme has raised eyebrows among skeptics. Saeed Puduza reports from London.
It is on track, says the British Prime Minister of his roadmap out of lockdown, as he confirms the next stage for easing coronavirus restrictions on April 12. Foreign travel will still be banned, yet the announcement came as a sigh of relief among a people for whom an end to the months-long lockdown couldn't come soon enough. But then Boris Johnson had this to say.
We're also publishing today on GovUK the early thinking on our four reviews on the safe return of major events, on social distancing, the potential role of COVID status certification.
Widely dubbed COVID vaccine passports, the idea has received a lot of heat from politicians and scientists alike. Some critics have described them as a recipe for discrimination and for a two-tier Britain.
We will end up with two queues at the supermarket, the football stadium, the pub. We'll be giving powers to bullying bouncers or bosses. And history suggests when you go down this segregation path, it's very, very difficult to come back.
So what are the so-called vaccine passports? Also described as immunity certificates, they'll come in the form of a piece of paper or information on an app to certify everyone has either been given a COVID-19 jab, has recently tested negative, or has caught and recovered from the disease. But are they an extra price Britons are prepared to pay for a seat in a restaurant or a movie theater?
There's potentially room for discrimination because obviously not everyone's going to be able to get the vaccination if they've got underlying health conditions. Does that mean they're not going to be able to go restaurants, cinemas, go on holiday?
Yeah, of course, no problem. I mean, I think it's a good idea, you know. It allows people to get back to normal life.
They're saying basically either you have the vaccine or you can't have a life, which is disgusting. It's absolutely, it's illegal, it's unethical, immoral, it's absolutely terrible.
The challenge facing this government now is to sell its so-called vaccination passport scheme to the parliament, a parliament whose members, some of them from the Prime Minister's own party, have already called it discriminatory and a worrying step towards making vaccination mandatory. Saeed Puriza, London.
After a fourth inconclusive election in Israel, in 2 years, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu now has a possible path to stay in office even as he stands trial on corruption charges. That came after Israeli President Reuven Rivlin tasked him with forming a new cabinet. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
As Israel's election, the fourth in the span of 2 years, resulted in no party winning a majority or holding enough support to form a governing coalition, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin has tasked the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to try to form a new cabinet. This came a day after holding consultations with political parties to hear their preferred candidate.
The Israeli president consulted the 13 parties in the newly elected parliament who should form the cabinet. Netanyahu received the recommendations of 52 lawmakers, while former Minister of Finance Yair Lapid had 45 endorsements. Even though I believe Netanyahu will fail again, he won't be able to enlist enough allies for a governing coalition.
According to the law, Netanyahu will have 28 days to bring together a coalition, with the option of requesting a two-week extension if necessary. If no cabinet is formed during that time, the Israeli president can task another candidate with trying to form a coalition. If no party is able to form a governing coalition, Israel may face an unprecedented fifth election in 2 years.
Netanyahu has two options. He should either succeed in forming the cabinet or he will go to a fifth election. In the last 2 years, the same scenario has been repeating. Everyone knows the political crisis won't be resolved now. Netanyahu succeeded in a divided Zionist society in a way that will only serve him and his interests.
While Netanyahu has a chance of securing another term in office, his trial for corruption, fraud, and bribery has resumed. He has pleaded not guilty to the charges. Netanyahu would not be compelled to resign as prime minister unless he's convicted with all appeals exhausted, something that could take several years. Netanyahu is desperate to stay in power. Experts say he can pass a new law that would grant him immunity as a sitting prime minister from being indicted, or he can use his public office to lash out against the prosecutors. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
That's a wrap for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Nasser Kandil, a well-known Lebanese journalist, warns about an underway campaign that seeks to alter the country's political configuration in a way that would mount excessive pressure on the resistance. We now present you an article authored by Robert Inlakesh, a journalist, writer, and political analyst who has lived in and reported from occupied Palestinian West Bank. The piece is titled Western Media Conspiracy Theories About Hezbollah Distract from Lebanon's Real Issues. Lebanon is clearly facing a crisis so severe that the country verges on complete collapse, but regardless of what the facts indicate, the Western Persian Gulf media continues to make the issue about Hezbollah. Following the nationwide protests over corruption and economic despair in October of 2019, Lebanon was plunged into an even greater crisis after former Prime Minister Saadeddine Hariri resigned. Despite several attempts to form a technocratic government, they have all, up to this point, failed and or formed only to quickly resign. Prime Minister-designate Saadeddine Hariri reportedly met again with the country's President Michel Aoun on Monday, 5th of April, in order to discuss the issue of government formation. Although there have been almost 20 meetings between the two men, yet they have not announced any breakthroughs. According to the International Monetary Fund, the Lebanese economy has shrunk 25% in the last year. The World Bank also reports that 50% of the country's population are below the poverty line, whilst the local currency has lost 90% of its value. Instead of the Western media focusing on the real underlying causes behind Lebanon's steep economic decline, they managed to turn everything into imaginative but infantile conspiracy theories instead, focusing on an alleged conspiracy in which the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement Hezbollah is secretly behind all of Lebanon's woes. The Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs is one such place that such conspiracy theories are found. According to a baseless claim by the Tel Aviv-based group, a scenario that could emerge as a result of Lebanon's economic collapse is the following. Iran will bring warships into the port of Beirut and take it over, take advantage of Hezbollah's control of Beirut International Airport and use it as a military airfield for its own purposes. At the same time, it will establish a military airfield in Baalbek. The fact that such a thing could even be published should come as something of a joke, but unfortunately some actually think that this scenario is likely to occur. On the contrary, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, has instructed the group to help those from all sects where possible and has called openly for formation of a technocratic political government. The hardships currently facing the Lebanese people are also not caused by Hezbollah in any way, for if there was any proof available to present to the public, that would be the main focus of the opinion pieces published by the likes of the New York Times and the Washington Post. Instead, what we see are pieces produced to condemn the group for pretty much everything else, ignoring the good done by the organization, such as aiding the Lebanese people throughout the ongoing pandemic and aiding needy people in general, as well as aiding those affected by Israeli military assault. The way that Lebanon operates is not like most other countries. Lebanon's constitution, that was adopted back in 1926 and set into law a system of confessionalism, which is to mean a de jure mix of religion and politics. The constitution itself, written by the French High Commissioner at the time, decided that there would be rules which dictate that the government would be run by different groups. This translated into the president always remaining a Maronite Christian, the prime minister of Lebanon a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker of parliament a Shia Muslim, and so on and so forth. Many Lebanese call into question the way in which the constitution, written under French rule, has fed into some divides, and we see today in the country. That is to say that Lebanon is governed by some officials who primarily take care of their own, and the government is not the sole provider for the people. Just a few years ago, Lebanon was a relatively stable country, and now it has started to shape up to its neighbor Syria economically. Lebanon's agricultural industry has been destroyed. Its biggest import partner, Syria, is under the chokehold of sanctions, which by extension target Lebanon too. The people of Lebanon have chosen to move their money out of the country, whilst non-governmental organizations are ever present and causing their own problems. Also, Lebanon has taken in as many as 1.5 million Syrian refugees, which has had its own impact on the country's economy. Then we have the foreign investors and tourists from the Persian Gulf Arab countries, and the fact that they largely control large portions of the economy. On top of this was the horrific Beirut explosion last year, which destroyed the country's primary port and highlighted the level of foreign interference and economic problems. But for all these problems and more, the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement Hezbollah is not to blame. The real reason we see so much attention placed upon Hezbollah is because they threaten the United States' top ally in the region, the Israeli regime. It is not because they are part of an alleged conspiracy to militarily take over Lebanon, or because they are the sole cause of the nation's financial crisis. It is because they were the ones to expel the Israeli occupation forces from southern Lebanon. It is for this reason that we see such disproportionate attention placed upon them in the media. Because if a civil war is manufactured in order to weaken them, this works in favor of the Israeli regime and the United States of America. Meanwhile, the well-known Lebanese journalist Nasser Gandil has warned about a campaign already underway that seeks to alter the country's political landscape in a way that would mount excessive pressure on the resistance axis. Nasser Gandil, a well-known journalist and editor of the Lebanese newspaper Al-Binar, said recently, "An external political campaign has been formed since the beginning of the country's crisis, with the aim of using the critical situation to create a new political reality in order to lay siege on the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement." He said the campaign had been formed with the support of media outlets and civil organizations, as well as elements both inside and outside of the country. Commenting on foreign sources' contribution to the campaign, Nasser Gandil identified the United States and France as the countries that have potentially fomented the crisis. The United States incessantly tries to interfere in Lebanon's domestic affairs, in favor of the Israeli regime. It has imposed economic sanctions on Lebanon to weaken the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah, which has defended the country against two Israeli wars and repeated Israeli aggression and violations. Meanwhile, France, Lebanon's former colonial ruler, is accused of trying to impose its political will on the country by pressing it to implement certain reforms. The well-known Lebanese journalist Nasser Gandil says Washington and Paris only claim to seek Lebanon's betterment whilst they take no action that could mirror their expression of such interest. He cited a recent overflight of Lebanon's coastline by an American drone, saying the unmanned aerial vehicle had patrolled the area in line with Washington's military ambitions for the country, not to pursue an alleged Russian submarine, as Washington has claimed. Mandil remarked, at the same time as it tries to find a military foothold in Lebanon, the United States also tries to weaken the Lebanese currency against the US dollar, so the Lebanese army grows more dependent on financial assistance from the Americans. However, Russia has tried to play a positive role towards resolution of the Lebanese crisis by recently hosting a Hezbollah delegation in Moscow and advising various parties in Lebanon to meet halfway towards formation of an official cabinet. Lebanon is experiencing its worst economic crisis in decades, compounded by the COVID-19 pandemic. Prices are skyrocketing and more than half of the population is now living below the poverty line. Nasser Gandil refused to consider the crisis and the protest that it has brought about to be simply self-sprung, saying the national currency's devaluation could not be tied to economic factors alone. He noted, "There are political efforts underway to pressure the market, thus provoking the people and paving the way for anarchy and insecurity." Delivering a recent speech, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Islamic Resistance Movement Hezbollah said Hassan Nasrallah also identified the pressure that the United States was applying to Lebanon as a main factor driving the current crisis in the country. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah stated that the United States wants Lebanon to be placed in the U.S.-Israel axis in the same way that such regional countries as the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have done by normalizing their relations with the Israeli regime through Washington's facilitation. Nasser Gandil voiced support for the solutions that have been proposed by Sayed Hassan Nasrallah towards ending the crisis in Lebanon, including reformation of the country's bureaucratic and financial structure and potential formation of a technocratic political government.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Delegations from Iran and the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are meeting in Vienna. On the agenda is ways to revive the deal from which former President Trump quit and President Biden promised to return to. An informed source has told Press TV that the only way for Tehran to go back to full-scale implementation of the deal hinges upon the verifiable removal of all U.S. unilateral sanctions. Tehran says if Washington lifts all its sanctions, Iran will stop its remedial measures and resume full compliance. Now, what's future holding for the 2015 Iran nuclear deal? How can the talks result in a breakthrough? Joining me in tonight's debate are co-founder of the Transnational Foundation, Jan Oberg from Lund, and also we have Professor of World Studies at the University of Tehran, Mohammad Marandi, who is joining us out of Tehran, the capital city, Tehran. Thank you for joining us on the program. Let's begin the show with what the head of the Iranian delegation at the talks in Vienna told Press TV right after the end of the first round of negotiations a couple of hours ago.
First, I'd just like to start with a question concerning comments that were published today in an interview with Mr. Mali, in which he says that the fact that Iran is calling for the removal of all of the sanctions before it can reverse its measures shows that Iran is not serious about reviving the deal. So are you saying then that after this session, are you saying that the U.S. has agreed on this demand from Iran that the U.S. should initially remove the sanctions fully before, and Iran should verify it before Iran can actually take action? Is that what the U.S. has agreed to?
Well, the U.S. was not in the session. What we had today was the Joint Commission of the JCPOA, and U.S. is not a participant. So we don't have any negotiation with the U.S., even indirect negotiations. What we do is to negotiate with the JCPOA participant, which you can perhaps say P4 plus 1. P4 plus 1 would then later would talk with Americans, and that is their business. We are not engaged in that business. We only negotiate with P4 plus 1, and we would we have told them very clearly what is our position. What Mr. Mali has said is in fact a sign of the lack of seriousness in their side, because they have left the JCPOA and they have imposed sanctions. So obviously, if they want to come back, they have lift all those sanctions all together in one step. That is quite logic, and that is a very reasonable demand by the Islamic Republic of Iran. We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance. So we have to make it clear that this is our position, but we are quite serious. I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. And after verification, we certainly go back to full compliance. If we wanted to avoid full compliance to the JCPOA, we would have done it before. We would have totally withdrawn from the JCPOA once the U.S. The previous U.S. administration left the JCPOA. So we are quite serious. Nobody can question Iran's goodwill. The JCPOA is alive because of Iran, and we have paid a heavy price for that. Our people have suffered from the sanctions imposed by the United States. And now, if they want to revive JCPOA, if they want to come back to the JCPOA, they should lift all sanctions at once.
Okay, now that was part of what Ms. Arakchi had to say. Now, let me go to London and ask Jan Oberg. As you heard, Mr. Arakchi stressed Iran opposes Washington's step-by-step offer. Iran insists the process should happen in one stage only. That is, the U.S. must lift all the sanctions to be able to go back to the JCPOA. Let's have your take.
Well, I think my take is very close to what we just heard. I have seldom been involved in a conflict where the parties were so clearly on the wrong side and right side. In most conflicts, you know, there are gray nuances on all sides. First of all, it's pretty obvious to the whole world that it was the United States that in 2015 participated in the negotiations and signed the deal under President Obama, whose vice president was the present president, Biden. So he knows what is in the deal. Now then, comes in an administration that decides to leave, depart from, which is a break of international law, because the deal was an appendix to the UN Security Council resolution, and then comes back with what is basically a Trump standpoint, that we can bully the world, we can do what we please, we can do this and that, we can demand this and that, and they must go first and all this. I mean, it's very simple to me, and that's my take on it, to answer your question. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has left, and it should join, and the U.S. has installed new sanctions on the Trump, and they should leave them and drop them. And then we are back to zero, if you will, or to the situation we were in. And it seems to me that, I mean, why does the United States not accept that there is a world out there and it cannot just bully and do what it wants and pleases? That time is over.
Okay, now back to Tehran. Mohammed, what do you expect to come out of the Vienna talks? Russian delegation has called it constructive. The Iranian delegation has dubbed it, Russians have said that's successful. Iranians saying it's constructive. Now, will the sessions that will be pursued on Friday come up with a pathway to settlement or what?
Well, the Iranian deputy foreign minister has said that there is no halfway settlement. It's all or nothing. The Iranians are not going to go through the same difficulties that it went before, and that is itself abiding by all of its commitments and then the Americans failing to abide by its commitments. Under Obama, the United States was dishonest. When the two sides signed the JCPOA, the Iranians immediately went and implemented the deal. It carried out all its obligations. And then the Americans dragged their feet. In some cases, they openly violated the deal, like passing the Iran Sanctions Act, which was a clear violation. This was under Obama. But what was even worse was that the United States, on paper, did one thing, but in reality, it did something else. So, for example, the U.S. government threatened banks, financial institutions, and shipping companies, as well as insurance companies, among others, and told them that you should not do business with Iran, otherwise you'll get into trouble. Bankers from the EU came to me, to my office, as an academic, to consult me about the situation. They told me themselves specifically that the Americans warned them not to do business with Iran. That was a clear violation. Mm-hmm. And the Iranian side, I think, was deceived by the Americans at the negotiating table and subsequently, because the Iranians assumed, I guess, that the Americans would act in good faith. So this time around, the Iranians are not going to accept that. The Iranians are saying verification. Full implementation and verification. This is a deal that was signed by the Obama administration. Biden was the vice president, so he accepts this deal, and therefore he has to implement the deal. If the Americans implement it, if it's verified, the Iranians will have no problem implementing the deal, because the Iranians have a long history of full implementation.
Okay. Now, let's listen to another piece of the comments made by Iranian chief nuclear negotiator, and I will ask you to comment on that.
After this discussion that you've had, the discussions here in Vienna, are we going to witness a change in the process or the kind of nuclear activities that are being carried out by Iran?
No. Before we come to any conclusion, there won't be any change in our policy.
And what about the pace of Iran's enrichment up to 20%? Is that going to undergo any change?
Well, no. What we are doing in 20% enrichment or any other activity in our nuclear program is based on our own needs, and that would be decided and planned by the Iran's Atomic Energy Organization. We are not going to change any policy before the U.S. is fully back to the JCPOA.
And just finally, the Russian ambassador said that he believed the talks today were successful. Do you see this these discussions as successful, positive? Do you think that the sides are on the right track and that this is going to lead to the eventual revival of the deal?
I think it was constructive and in the right track. It's too soon to say that it has been successful. That would be known after the work of the working groups. But of course, we are hopeful. If we were not hopeful, we would have not been here. We would move based on our own policies, on our own instructions. If the other side can, meet our demands, of course, then we can say that it's a successful negotiation.
Okay, now, let me ask Yan about what he thinks about what the Iranian nuclear chief negotiator said, especially regarding the fact that he just stressed that Iran is not going to change any of its policy activity before the U.S. returns to the deal. And you know what we mean by U.S. returning to the deal.
Well, I think it would be obvious to the world that if the U.S. stood by its word, it would have been better. Now, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, and the only way I see, and in that sense, I completely agree with what was said, there's only one way back, and that is that the U.S. repairs its foolish policies by going back to the deal and lifting the sanctions it put on Iran unilaterally. And secondly, I don't understand why this should be so difficult for the U.S., except because you're a superpower and you think you can get away with everything and bully the world. That type of world does not exist anymore because the U.S. is in decline on all important indicators. I don't understand why Biden should need a quid pro quo, some kind of deal, a new deal or something like that. He would be immensely popular everywhere, including in Europe, where the secondary sanctions have been so hurtful to European industry, because, as we just heard, Europe would be punished if it exported or traded with Iran. I have experienced this myself because I tried to use the Nordea Bank to send a little sum for humanitarian aid when you had floods in Iran. It was returned because they could not send a few dollars. It was blew up. You couldn't send anything, not even humanitarian assistance to Iran. And so what I'm saying is he would be popular. He would be looking like a decent man saying, oh, the fool who was there before me, I'm now repairing what he did wrong. Let's get to the table. Let's get moving on and find some kind of win-win situation for Iran and us. And, if Iran should say, yeah, okay, we'll do this and that, that it pleases the U.S., why should they? I mean, the U.S. has cheated Iran a number of times. And secondly, there is no way in that case that the Americans would let them not raise new demands, such as we have to discuss, all kinds of issues that was not in the 2015 deal. So I would completely agree. You have to stand firm now and say, repair the foolish things you did on your side, and then we can talk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's common sense. I mean, it's common sense and it's fairness.
Sure. Now, Professor Marandi, are you optimistic that Washington will take the required action and help revive the Iran nuclear deal? Head of the Iranian negotiator said that he's in Vienna to do business, but he's wondering if the other side is serious enough. He also reminded the fact that Iran has paid a heavy price to keep the JCPOA alive, and the other side has not done much.
Yes, it doesn't seem as if he is particularly optimistic, and why should he be? If Biden was serious, he could have signed presidential decrees during the very first day of his presidency like he did with a host of other issues, but he didn't. He continued Trump's maximum pressure campaign. So Biden continues to target Iranian women and children. On the other hand, we have to remember that Biden has a very dark history. The dirty war in Syria grew very horrible during the period when he was the vice president. And we know that Jake Sullivan, who is now his national security advisor, on February 12, 2012, said that al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. So from the very beginning in Syria, they were working with al-Qaeda, the same group that a decade before had attacked the United States. When he was vice president, the United States destroyed Libya the United States gave the green light to Saudi Arabia to create, to bring about genocide in Yemen, and of course the sanctions targeting women and children in Venezuela. And of course, the whole maximum pressure campaign against Iran that Trump pursued was initiated by Obama. And again, Biden was his vice president. And it was only after the United States agreed to that it would not complain and that it would recognize Iran's right to enrichment that talks began in the first place. So Biden is not a humane person. He's committed all sorts of atrocities. And so the Iranians don't have great expectations. But the United States needs an agreement. If they didn't need an agreement, they wouldn't be so keen on negotiating. Mm-hmm. So the Iranians have leverage. The difficulties inside the United States make it more difficult for the United States to impose its hegemony over the rest of the world. So that helps to weaken the sanctions. The United States needs an agreement. And the Iranians know that. But Iranians are not going to appease the United States. It's full implementation, verified implementation, then full Iranian implementation. There's no other model. There's no other way out of this.
Okay. Now, Yan, U.S. officials are also attending the Vienna talks on the JCPOA. Of course, Tehran has asserted it's not going to negotiate with them, be it directly or indirectly. Now, is the U.S. presence there a good omen, or is it just publicity stunt by the Biden administration?
I really cannot tell. I would be honest with you if I said I knew that the answer to that question. But I could have a nasty mind that you want these negotiations. You play the game that you want some kind of, you know, impossible thing to happen, and then you say, "Oh, there you see, Iran is not willing to do anything. We better." Use bigger languages, bigger letters with them. And here I think of the likelihood of some kind of bombing of facilities or something like that. I would not be surprised. There's little that should surprise us by now. And I do find it strange that you have this policy in the Biden administration and at the same time trying to look like you want to find a solution, because what you're offering is totally of no interest to the Iranian side, and it's Iran who has legality and morals on its side in this case. So, you know, if all this fails and nothing else works, my hope would be that the world, including particularly, but I'm not very hopeful about the European countries, EU countries, a global civil disobedience campaign, and that company after company, bank after bank, in the hundreds of thousands begin to work and break these secondary sanctions, begin to work and say sorry over there in Washington. We have our interests too, and we're not going to accept that American law is implemented on European or other territories. And the second thing that is likely to happen, and that's why I say all these policies are self-defeating for the United States. So it's the Cold War with Russia, so it's the emerging Cold War with China. Mm-hmm. It tells me that there's no sense of reality in Washington at the moment. But you know what it ends up with rather quickly, and there are very clear signs of it, is that country after country will turn its back on the United States and the West. And it cannot be in the interest of anybody in the West that that happens. But I'm not very optimistic, as I said, because the European Union is simply not able to get its act together on any important issues, as we've seen most lately in the case of the corona, meeting the corona challenge.
Exactly. Okay, Mohammed, some observers argue that this could be the last chance for the nuclear deal, given the Iranian parliament's stance and also the upcoming presidential election here in Iran. Do you agree?
The implementation of the nuclear deal doesn't have anything to do with the Iranian presidential election. Ayatollah Khamenei said Iran is very patient and we're not in a hurry. And that basically means that we're not going to rush into some sort of situation where we do not get exactly what we are supposed to get in the nuclear deal. Iran this time round is going to learn from its past experience. In the past, forget Trump. Trump, of course, tore the deal, imposed maximum pressure. He's gone now. Mm-hmm. Biden, who claims to want to go back to the deal, he has to implement the deal. the deal under Obama-Biden wasn't implemented. They cheated Iran. The negotiations had flaws, and the Americans took advantage of the flaws in the agreement. The Iranians are now saying, we won't let that happen again. Okay. The agreement has to be fulfilled in full. The example I gave is a key example. The Iranians need to be able to use the global financial sector. The U.S. sanctions, by the way, are completely illegal. They are utterly illegal. And it directs at third countries. It's a thuggish policy to threaten countries who work with Iran with sanctions. But in any case, Iran, the most important thing for Iran, among many important things, is for Iran to be able to use the global banking sector.
Okay.
And the United States never allowed that to happen under Obama and Biden. So this time around, that's why the Iranians are very clear about verification. It must be implemented in full and verified.
Right.
No matter how we talk about it, this is the ultimate result that will be acceptable to Iran.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I have to jump in. I'm sorry. That's all the time we have. Let me thank our guests. We have co-founder of the Transnational Foundation, Jan Åberg from Lund, Sweden, and professor of world studies at the University of Tehran, Mohammad Marandi, who joined us from Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it